Yeah, I wish we were up to this part here. It says the closing prayer. First of all, my name is Jimmy. I'm a recovered addict. You notice I said recovered. There's a lot of discussion about should we be recovered or recovery. We say both around here, so you can take your choice. It's one of the things I like about this program. We always have a choice. Bob just told a few of you what he thinks. And see, as far as I'm concerned, if you want to talk, that's fine. If you've really got something to say, I'll sit down right there and listen to you. I'll tell you why. One of the reasons I said that is I'm going to go back a little ways. I'm going to go back to 1962. Or around, I think the spring, early summer, just about maybe about this time. And at that time, I was married to another woman. My kids were fairly small, a couple of them. Coming home from work one afternoon, I turned the radio on, and I heard some news that disturbed me greatly. I heard that SOB Khrushchev was coming to Los Angeles. Maybe some of you weren't even born then, and maybe this is old history, you know. But I got so incensed when I heard that, I went home and I said to my wife, tomorrow afternoon I'm coming home from work early. I want you to have some bags packed. And we're taking off. I won't breathe the same smog as that SOP. And she said, I don't care what the thing is that takes us out of town for a couple of days. I'm willing. Let's go, you know. So what I want to prove is how manageable our lives become after we're on the program for a while. You know, maybe some of you are going through that phase. How nice it is to be able to manage your life again. Make meaningful choices. You know, all those good words we hear at meetings and from our sponsors and a lot of other people that we don't listen to half the time, you know, which is about my way of doing things too, you know. I try to find the person who agrees with me. Then I feel that I've been approved, and I go ahead on it, you know. And that'll probably sink in a little bit later in the program, you know. But anyway, it shows you the manageability that I had gotten into my life. I could cope with things and make decisions, you know. And the first step seemed a long, long ways away in the background at that time, when I'd had to admit that I was powerless over my addictions, and that my life had become unmanageable. Because it felt good to be able to do these things that I decided upon, you know. So the result was, anyway, that we took off. We didn't know where we were going, but we wound up late Friday night up in a motel up in Santa Barbara. Now, I never spent much time in Santa Barbara, but I thought it'd be nice in the morning to go see the mission and go to the museum and a few other things like that. But it didn't quite turn out that way. We had a nice day. I went over to a clubhouse up there for the AA meetings, and I got the coldest shoulder that I ever got anywhere. And I left there in a hurry. I went back the next day, the next morning, and found some of the guys in the kitchen. You know, if you want what we have most of the time, the place to get it is right back there. You know, not so much out here. Go back in the kitchen. Get your hands wet, you know, do some dishes. Yeah, go chase something to eat and talk to the guy that's shaking so goddamn bad, or the gal that's shaking so bad that they can't sit here, even on their hands. You know, that's where I learned what this program was all about. But anyway, the next morning was Sunday morning, and I felt so good about getting away from L.A. and away from that SOB, because I used to lay all my resentments on the communists, because then I didn't have to blame any of my friends or myself for what was going on. Okay? That's known as passing the buck, you know. I guess there's another word for it. I can't grasp it right at the present time. But anyway, that's what I was doing. So we went out, and the family went to church, and I drove around town a little bit. I picked them up. We started to go down to the museum in Santa Barbara, and I didn't know it didn't open until 1 o'clock in the afternoon. So here we are, about 10:30 in the morning, gallivanting around Santa Barbara, not knowing what to do, not knowing anybody up there. So There's a little park I saw, so we went down to this little park. It was right next to the railroad station. So I went over to a bar over there and got a cup of coffee and was sitting there. And, of course, in this bar, like most other bars, there's always a good loud drunk, you know. And he's arguing with the chef back in the kitchen. And I pick up what he's saying, and I said to the bartender, I said, what's going on with this character, you know? He said, he wants the knife. I said, what the hell does he want a knife for? Is he going to cut his throat, you know? He says, no. He says, some Ruskies are coming in on the train. And he says he's going to kill them, you know? I said to myself, what the hell is going on? Here I have managed everything so beautiful, and here I am. You're right. I went over to the station, and the train stopped, and off they got, all his bodyguards. And I stood closer than I am to Bob right now. And I'm telling you, I thought to myself, you stupid son of a bitch. You come all the way up to Santa Barbara and you didn't bring your gun with you. And I looked at that little pig-faced, bald-headed, you know what, and I thought to myself, it's a good thing I didn't. It wouldn't be worth it, you know, it wouldn't be worth it. And there's a big commotion behind me, and here was the cat from the bar, and he had gotten a knife somewhere, and he was trying to make it over there. When part of the camera crew from TV grabbed him, and then a couple of cops grabbed him and took him away. So I just showed you how well we come to manage our own lives. Now, that's a bit of my own experience. Now, the other reason for telling you that, how manageable my life is today, is that I thought, generally, I just talk off the top of my head at any given time, because I don't speak often at a big meeting. I speak mostly at small meetings, or at the office, or at my house. We have three or four people sitting around the table. That's the way I still like it, because I think we can get a little bit more honest that way. You know? Like you, I'm inclined to talk ahead of myself when I'm up here. I'm inclined to talk about what I hope it will be like rather than what it really is like right now. Now, that's a natural thing, because our particular way of living, I think, has always been that way. We've always been a step ahead of ourselves in what we hope for, what we would like to see, what we'd like to be, what we would like to become. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I think it's basic to our nature. We always want the better things in life for ourselves. But anyway, I sat today and I thought, well, I'm going to get my thoughts in order. There's a few things I'd like to talk about, but I got to have some notes on it. So I proceeded very quickly today to run through my head and run through a few other things. And got about 8 pages of notes, big lettering, about the size of this, you know. And then I left them home. So here I am, and all I'm going to be able to talk about is what I usually talk about, what it's like right now, where I'm at, what I think of the program, what I understand, some parts of the program, how I handle some of the things that come up in my life. And I'll probably be out in left field most of the time. And if you can follow me, fine. If you can't, well, that's just the way it is. Because I take things pretty much a day at a time, an hour at a time. And I'll have to start a long ways and perhaps give you some indication of the kind of person I am now, the kind of person I was in the beginning. Because I don't think that we change that much, any of us. In our inner life, our inner living, I think we do become what we've always been directed toward. I wasn't born in the United States. I was born a long, long way from here. I was born in Paisley, Scotland. And I grew up in a family that was pretty closely knit, very religious family. My father was on the stage. He was a headliner. He was a comedian. We had a lot of fun in our life. We had a lot of laughter, a lot of singing. I became a dancer when I was very, very young. And that sort of laid out a pattern for much of my life. Because every competition I was ever in, I won. Except one. And that one, I kicked off a shoe during one of my routines. And the judges disqualified me because I kicked off a shoe, even though I continued in the competition. And There was a big uproar went up because of this. And the judges wouldn't change their mind. They declared that I was the best dancer there, but that they were not going to give me the trophy. And that sort of laid out something in my life. I always had to be up front. I always had to be number one. And I think maybe today, in some ways, it's still that way. I don't think that's necessarily bad or wrong, but I think it's something that I have to be very careful of. Because like so many other people, my ego is pretty strong. I've got a lot of pride. I hate to be a loser because I felt that I was a failure for so many years. And I hate to lose at anything. And it's pretty difficult at times for me yet not to push my way in. But you see, I've always found out in my life I never had to push my way to the front. People always pushed me to the front. I never liked too much responsibility. As I say, I have to be very careful of my nature as I know it, not maybe as you see it or think you know me. See, I know me better than any one of you do. It means to me that at any given time, I have to be careful of Jimmy Kennedy, see? Because I know the extent that I can go to even without thinking and pushing myself ahead in the ego area. It's very easy for me to do that. Now, I have to be very careful of it. And that's one of the reasons that I don't exert control in my life. Rather, I discipline myself to do only certain things. I don't speak at many big meetings because it is inclined to build me up within my own self to something that I'm not. I'm pretty much a private person. I don't like to reveal myself too much to too many people. I've always been that way. I'm practically a loner at times. I'm not a recluse, as some people state, but I prefer sometimes myself and the things I am doing with perhaps one other person, my wife in particular, to getting out in the crowd. I prefer it that way. It's nothing to be proud of and to be ashamed of. That's just the way I am. And I feel sometimes that I get pushed into a corner. And I've been pushed and pulled by so many pressures throughout my life, including the addictions, that I resent it almost within myself to even feel the way I do. I hope you can understand what I'm saying there. And sometimes it's very hard to talk to people who are new. I know there's a lot of people new, fairly new to the program at this meeting tonight. And I'm always concerned with a newcomer. I'm inclined at times to get into myself, even when I'm speaking, and get lost in what I'm trying to tell myself. Because here we're not teachers, we're not preachers. We're here to learn, every one of us, from the first time we come to a meeting. I remember when I made my first meeting, how afraid I was. I still case every place I walk into. I want to know where the nearest door is out and where the nearest window is. And I sit facing the door. Because I want to get out in a hurry if anything happens. You know? It's always been that way. I don't turn my back to a door. Yet. You know? I guess that's self-survival. I've gotten too many problems backing myself into a corner. So I try to leave that area open. Most important thing to me, of course, when I speak to anyone, is basically the steps. When we discuss the steps to any great length, I think all we do is complicate them and make them harder to understand and harder to work. The steps are everything in my life today. I don't have to consciously work them. But I have to work them. This program becomes such a part after a while that you work it naturally. When I first came around, I had to work it because there was no other way to go. If I didn't work it, I was going to die. That's where I was. I came in, I was an abject failure in every department of life. And I mean that completely and fully. There was nothing left. And I had to surrender. I had to give up. And in doing that, it was hard because I couldn't think. I couldn't speak. It took me about 6 months to be able to put more than one sentence together at any given time. And I used to get so angry at myself that people would walk away from me. I would try to say something and my tongue would fall over my eye teeth and I couldn't see what I was saying, you know? It was terrible. And I would get so angry I'd leave the building and I'd go out and pound on a wall, you know? Hit my head against the plaster, you know? Punch my way through doors, put my hands, you know? So angry at me, you know? I didn't know how to change. I didn't know how to have any affection for me as a person. I hated myself so much, I'd look in the mirror and I'd spit in the mirror in the morning. This was even after I was clean and sober for a while. And I didn't know what to do. And I went along like this, but staying clean. And I got a cake after a year. And right up to 10 minutes before I got the cake, I wasn't sure whether I could accept it or not. Because I didn't know whether I'd been clean all that time. I think I wasn't confused. I did not know. And I said to a guy I knew, I said, I don't think I can go up and get that cake. He said, why not? I said, because I don't think I've been on the program for a year. He said, where have you been every night? And sometimes during the day. I said, I've been at meetings 2-3 times a day. 14 meetings on a weekend from Friday night to Monday noon, you know. Up into the jail. Up into the road camps, you know. And he said, well, would you come to a meeting if you'd been loaded? I said, hell no. He said, then you got a year in. That's the basis that I took my cake because I wasn't sure, you know. And after a little while, I began to get in real trouble then, mentally, emotionally, and spiritually. I guess this is the part that goes into the 12th step. You know, I'm jumping from the first to the 12th step. But sometimes that's the way we are in the beginning. It's all we seem to know. Try to stay clean a day at a time and try to help somebody else. All the other steps will fall into place as we go along. Stay clean. And I ran into a lot of trouble. I ran into trouble with my family. I couldn't sit down and eat a meal with my family for 2.5 years. Talk about emotionally ill. Incomplete. Ill-equipped to live, you know. I could scarcely work. But I kept going to meetings, kept talking to people, kept going on 12-step calls. And I got so bad one time I couldn't get out of my bedroom. A year and a half on the program, couldn't leave my bedroom. And I couldn't talk. I sat there like a vegetable. I couldn't open my mouth. My wife at that time came in, she said, what's wrong? She said, you want a cup of coffee? You want a cigarette? And I sat for 3 days like that, on the side of the bed, at the bathroom to get rid of the coffee and back to bed, as far as I could go. I couldn't leave the house. I was terrified. I had more fear in me then than I ever had previously. I was afraid to leave the house. I had nothing to depend on. I hadn't found any kind of higher powers I could depend on. And I didn't want what the religionists had been trying to give me all my life. Because you see, when I was a kid, I never played hooky from school. I loved school because I could learn there. But I played hooky from church every chance I got. I couldn't stand all that stuff they were telling me because I didn't believe it, you know. And I would take off and I'd go up into the hills in Scotland. Up in the hills above town. In fact, I saw a little something just this morning on TV, a little flash. I guess it was this afternoon. One of those old Tammy shows. She was up in the hills looking down on the town. And it took me right back to those times when I was 7, 8 years old. And I'd go up there and I'd look down on the town. And I'd look over the old castle ruins. And I'd lay there in the heather, smell the heather. And I felt so good compared to what I felt when I was with people and down in town and helping my father with his act and dancing. That was all fine, but it wasn't me. You know? I was always afraid. Okay? Thank God that fear is gone. I'm at ease now. Well, very often I'm uncomfortable, but I'm at ease. Like everybody else, I was uncomfortable coming up here before the meeting. I get the butterflies, I get the jitters. But once I'm into doing what I'm doing, I can go ahead. I can feel at ease about it. But to get back to the main thrust of this thing, is that I reached this point where nothing was going to make any change in my life. And then this thing we talk about in the 12th step, where we seem to have some kind of experience that alters the inner workings, that alters us somewhere down deep so that we take a different course. Third day, I'm trying to go to sleep late at night in my own bedroom, dark. And I fell asleep for a little while, and I woke up complete and abject terror. I didn't know what was wrong. I had many experiences like that, as most of you know, at different times, terrors. But this was different. I didn't know what I was afraid of. I didn't have any idea what was happening. And I couldn't move, which was the worst part. I was actually immobile, like a piece of wood laying there, and I couldn't move. I couldn't think. I couldn't scream. I couldn't ask for help. And I saw a great, big, round glow of light ahead of me. It was like a big argent disc hammered silver. You know what hammered silver looks like? And there were two big posts on each side with a caduceus around them and some steps. If you think I was afraid before, you can imagine how afraid I was then. Because now I knew they were going to get me, you know. For all these years, I've been able to stay out of those places. Now I know they're going to get me, you know. And a voice out of nowhere said, "Don't be afraid. Don't be afraid." I couldn't move. But as soon as it hit me, the impact hit me, I loosened up. And I wasn't afraid. And the voice told me what to do. And I said, "I can't do that. I can't do that." And the voice then said something to me that told me just how deep, whatever this was that was talking to me, how deeply it knew me. Because it laughed and it said, "You shyster, you." And I knew exactly what it meant. I was doing again what I'd always done. The indirect approach, the indirect answer, the indirect question, never face anything head on. My whole life, never face anything head on. And I had to change. And I said, what can I do? And I was told what to do. And part of that's the reason this program, I'm not going to tell you the exact words, but part of that's the reason this program has come into existence. Because I was told what to do. And that was a profound experience to me, because for 24 hours I knew complete and absolute serenity. Complete serenity. I knew that everything is all right with the world. That half the time I only get in my own way. If I'm just follow directions according to my own conscience on the inside, that things will work out. I still forget it at times, but that's the way it's been most of the time. I've never forgotten one word of what happened. I could draw you a picture. I have drawn a picture of this. The only thing I can tell you is that that voice was a higher power, first higher power I really ever found, because I understood it. I understood what it was saying, and I understood where it was coming from. Somewhere deep inside of me where I'm connected to this universe, something came through, because I could never believe in the conceptual gods that most people have believed in. I saw so much difference in my family background. You know, from Catholicism to Presbyterianism and all the ways in between, it confuses a child, you know, when you have people that you know. And yet as a child, I always seemed to know there was something more for me. Now, when I was a very, very small kid, I always run around with older people. Now, I'm not talking about at 7 years old and running around with kids 9 years old. I associated with men 60 and 70 years old. They were the people I liked to be with because they had interesting things to tell me and interesting things to show me. The one man I made great friends with was over 70. He was an explorer, an archaeologist, and an ornithologist. And I used to watch all the things that he had collected and all his travels over the years. And I was so interested in these things. I wanted to do them too. And my other very, very close friend was the town drunk. And he was a great guy, you know. He was so good to me in so many ways. And he was such a louse on another, so many others, you know. And he used to fall down the stairs and break himself open and break his leg, break his head open, and the blood would be running down 2-3 flights of stairs, you know. And one time when I'm about 7 1/2, he fell down the stairs and I found him, and the blood was running down 3 flights of the concrete steps, you know. I found him, I went running in to get my mother. We got him into a hospital, and I used to keep saying to her, "When can we see Mr. Cruikshank?" She said, next week. This kept going on. Finally, I said, "I have to see him." She said, "All right." So she took us up to a place called Crow Road. Which means Crow Road. This was the nut house. We're up in this beautiful grounds of this nut house. And here he is sitting in a chair, a wheelchair. And he's just staring straight ahead. He can't see me, and I couldn't understand why he couldn't see me, why he couldn't talk to me. I said, "What is wrong with him?" She said, "He's a sick man." I said, what do you mean sick? She said, "He drank too much and got hurt too much over the years." And I didn't say anything after that. They took him away. As we were walking down the big pathway down to get the trolley car to go home, she said, "Why are you so quiet?" I said, "Well, I'll tell you. When I grow up, I'm going to help people like Mr. Cruikshank. I've never forgotten that. Because I wondered at that time what I meant." So you see, the course was laid out for me. I had to become an alcoholic and an addict to fulfill my destiny. I went to school. I went to a prep school in Pennsylvania to study for the ministry, thinking that was one of the ways I had to go. Well, I lasted there about 3 years. You know, I couldn't make it. I stole all the wine I could get my hands on. We had 17 altars down one side, you know, and 3 in the front. And half the time, there was just barely enough wine left for the priest to say Mass, you know. And, of course, you know the job I had, you know. I worked in the sacristy, naturally. So after they found out about that, then I went down the cellar and found out how to get in the wine cellar. Snake the stuff out from underneath, you know, push the dirt back again so they couldn't see where it went. Then after that, I got a job as what we called, can't remember the name of it now, but it was taking care of the good father's rooms, cleaning up, you know, getting their books, drinking their whiskey is what it was, really, you know, because I could go to 6 or 7 rooms in the morning and I'd feel pretty good by first class time, you know. Then I wouldn't have to go over the wall that night and go down to the village. And by the way, in that village, which is back in Pennsylvania, we've got 2 NA meetings going right now. Okay? One's called the Cornwell Heights meeting, and that's where I went to school. Most of my buddies there that continued their studies all became the kind of people that I had wished in years gone by that I could become. They're professors. They're past presidents of a university. All of them. You know? The ones that are not dead. And here I am. I met one of them not too long ago. He's a member of AA. I met him after 26 years in Africa as a missionary. I met him right here in San Fernando Valley. He's got 15 years on the program at that time, 18 years now. Yeah. Our paths cross, you know. So maybe I haven't said too much. I don't even know what time it is or how long this is supposed to last. Is there going to be a dance after this, Frakus? Okay, then. I'm going to wind this up pretty soon. And perhaps I can come back some other time. But I just would like to say a few things about H&I committees, but how difficult it was. You see, I used to say many years ago, I know Bob and probably some of the others here, remember, I used to say, I believe that this program will work best from the inside out. I think if we can carry the message to the inside, and these people grasp it there and come out, This will really make it grow. I found out I was wrong. It didn't really grow much from the outside in either, you know, until recently. But I remember some of the first contacts we had with officials. I remember the very first time we ever tried to carry the message of NA into an institution. We tried to carry it into Max up at the Castaic. And after the first meeting, we were asked not to come back. The one guy that was leading the meeting, he took up all the time, and all he did was talk down to the people that were in there, you know. And they didn't like it, and neither did the people in the institution, so they asked, please don't come back. Which was all right, we were learning, you know. The next time, we went down to TI with another guy, and one of the people in the back row at that time, sitting back there, and we could hear him. He was making all the usual wisecracks, and turned out about a year later, he walked into a meeting over in on War Park at the church, and Bob remembers him. Old hip slick Phil, whose story is in the little white book, he walked in there, and we tricked him there too, you know. And then he told us how well he was doing in the H&I committee in AA, and that he really didn't need this Narcotics Anonymous bit, you know. And I asked him after the meeting, I said, are you going to come back for some more meetings? He said, well, I don't think so. No, he said, I'm too busy doing the things I like to do where I am, you know, going into the institutions and carrying the message. I said, well, we need the message carried too, you know. And he said, well, I don't know. Well, naturally, I had to hook him in, you know, because I'm still not as straightforward maybe as I'd like to be. See? So I said, well, that's too bad because I was going to ask you to leave the meeting next Friday night. And, of course, he took the bait, you know, and he was back the next Friday night with some of his friends, and we had a good meeting. And he continued to come back. So I don't care how we get people into the program, as long as they come and they want what we have. See? See, there are times when I feel that I'm not making contact with newcomers enough. My higher power works kind of funny with me. See? Generally, when I ask for a newcomer, I ask this way for me. I say, I want somebody for a little while that wants this program. I don't care if they only want it for today, for tonight, for 2 hours. I just want them to want it for a little while. See? Because that's the desire. It can be increased. It can be built on. It can be drawn out. See? You know, within anywhere from 24 minutes to 24 hours, I always get somebody brand new. Strange the way the higher power works. There's always somebody either calls, walk into in strange places, you know, run into them in men's rooms, walk into them in restaurants, you know, stop to get an ice cream cone someplace and walk into somebody and introduce them to the program. That's planting the seed, you know. I think one of the things that I continue to do probably is to just to give myself as completely as I can to this program, because it is my whole life. It doesn't mean that I don't have many other things to do. I don't have enough time to do everything I want to do. I sometimes wonder if all of us got together and asked our higher collective higher power to make the days 48 hours long and the weeks 23 days long, that maybe we could catch up with ourselves. Yeah? But I doubt if that'll ever happen. So the only other way I can do that probably is to live to be like 250. So I've said before that to people who come through this program and that I meet at meetings, I'm going to be around here for a long, long time. So you're going to have to put up with me, because I'm not going to leave. But I hope that you hang around too. Because maybe, if we all stick together, we will find unity in this program. We will learn how to apply the traditions, which is the only thing that will make the fellowship grow. And we will be able to carry the message to every corner of the earth, whether it's in an institution here, or in Bangkok, or in Thailand, in Scotland, in Poland. By the way, we're behind the Iron Curtain now. We've got two meetings in Poland. You'd be surprised what's going on. There's a Catholic priest down in Brazil I translated a little part of the white book. And I'm trying to get in touch with them. I've called them a number of times. I can't reach anybody down there. So I've had to write to them. There's more calls for help coming in from different parts of the world than ever has before. We need everybody. We don't need just a few people. Every member of Narcotics Anonymous is needed in some way. None of us have it made. That's the unfortunate thing that happens to us so often. We think we have it made. We can't all give all our time, but we can be the program, because you are the program. You're the only program that some people will ever see, whether in or out of an institution. And what's your image? Is it false or is it real? You know, sometimes I'm so doggone much off the wall that I couldn't get serious if I tried. Tonight I just happen to be serious, because I realize more than ever when I look around a room like this, there's so many people. And I remember the times we used to sit with two and three of us around a table at the only meeting in the entire world. I remember one time Bob said to me, he said, well, what did we have to do all that other stuff for? This was after he got out of Tehachapi last time, by the way. He still has a little resentment towards me, you know. Because I wrote to him when he was up in Tehachapi and answered his letter, and I sent him up to start a kit and said, get a meeting started, and didn't enclose any money for him. Right, Bob? He didn't need any money. What did he need money for? Get in trouble? He was in enough trouble as it was, you know. Yeah. Remember, a lot of times we had to do that. And he said, well, what do we need all this stuff for? I said, because one of these days there's going to be a lot of kids that are not born yet. They're going to need what we have to offer them. Thank God we have what we have to offer. Not just new people, but the kids of the members who weren't even born at that time. We've got something to offer the world. I wish I could remember the thing I wrote this afternoon on that last page that I was going to wind up this talk with. I can maybe give it to you, not in the verse that it's written in, but maybe I can give it to you in essence. And I was thinking, you know, if there was ever an epitaph that I would like to see on my headstone, if I have a headstone, I'll probably be buried at sea, though. If there's ever an epitaph written, it might go something like this. All we did was sow some seeds and work and wrought to make this work so that we and others might live in peace, in freedom, and in love.